This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, April 4th, 2016. I'm Caleb Brown. When you or I think about helping the poorest people in the world, we typically think about donating to charitable groups that provide relief from the ravages of poverty. But that kind of thinking and those kinds of quote-unquote help for the poor might actually be extending many of the problems that contribute to poverty. Mark Weber is a co-producer of the film Poverty, Inc. We spoke today.
The starting point in the film was, I think I have to look to our leadership, which is our director of the film, Michael Matheson Miller. It's a very interesting background. He did a master's in international development in Japan and lived there for 5 years, studied international business in Europe and lived there. And then he actually taught as a philosophy professor in Latin America. And I think in this film, you see the convergence of those three, the market economics, development, and also philosophy. And what he describes is his experience in Japan was being overwhelmed by this sense in the development community, quote unquote, of this social engineering mindset, this top-down power structure that really, on a more philosophical level, turns the poor into the objects of our charity and sentimentality. And I think that the driving conversation that we kept having when we were in the beginning stages of this piece were always stemmed from that starting point of the human person, and then rippled out into what does the ecosystem look like that facilitates human flourishing. And what we began to realize is that a lot of what is done in the charity and aid world actually undermines the project of creating that healthy ecosystem. It can undermine governance structures, it can undermine local economies, and it can undermine culture. And that's what we wanted to bring attention to and really flip the question on its head, the question of how do we address poverty. Rather, instead think, how do we create ecosystems that facilitate human flourishing? How do we create wealth? And wealth not in the strictly material sense of GDP, but in the deeper philosophical sense.
In combating poverty, and as you just mentioned, that might not be the right way to think about it, what is the role typically of international aid organizations?
Well, the really interesting thing is, and a theme of the film is questioning our core assumptions. And I think we have to question whether or not this term, international development, is even legitimate. There's no country in the world that's been developed by teams of international development people. There's no track record or empirical tests that can show us that this model works. And the most recent Nobel Prize winner in economics, Angus Deaton, said he can find no statistical correlation, let alone a causal relationship between aid and development. Now, that doesn't mean that anecdotally or in certain instances we can't save lives. Every life matters, and there's lots of cases that we can point to where lives were changed or saved for the better. But we can't confuse life-saving interventions and sustainable development. And so when we think about what is the role, I think I think that the role can be limited to life-saving interventions or relief, for instance. But even then, we have to find ways to engage in that regards and strengthens local capacity as opposed to displacing local producers. And in a lot of cases, including the recent earthquake in Haiti just a few years ago, we see that the effort to provide relief actually extended the crisis rather than helping to ameliorate it. And that's where we have to be really careful.
So with a title like Poverty, Inc., as someone who generally believes in free markets and trying to help people secure their own well-being, what groups depend on maintaining or extending the problems of poverty?
I think a great area where we can learn a lot is about this particular intersection is in agriculture. And in agriculture, we see the U.S. government subsidize heavily this industry, so heavily that we create a massive surplus. And that surplus threatens the price stability of our market. We're overproducing, in other words, and if that surplus is released on our own market, prices will fall and people will be up in arms. So we have to do something with that surplus. So we put it into ethanol, or we put it into, or as much as we can, we trade it with other nations. But then a lot of it ends up going into gifts in kind as well to nonprofit organizations who can then, with the stipulation that they can sell that those in-kind donations or food commodities, for instance, in foreign markets at a lower, usually at a lower than market price. Now, the organization, the NGO, this benefits them in terms of the revenue that they generate from those sales. It also, they see it as part of their mission to be able to provide food to meet this need of hunger, to provide food and sell food at a lower than market price in a place like Haiti, for instance. The problem is that what's happening is, on a number of levels, in our own domestic economy, we're undermining the marketplace by disallowing or at least distorting the communication between consumers and producers. And by that I mean the government, when it ends up subsidizing these industries so heavily, inevitably it ends up picking winners and losers in the marketplace. And if you look closely at the way these subsidies fall out, last I checked, over 80% of the subsidies, ag subsidies, were going to about 10 corporations in America. Now, being pro-competitive markets means that doesn't mean that you're pro those 10 corporations, right? Those 10 corporations are benefiting from rigging the competitive system rather than from upholding it. And this is one of the dangers where the power consolidations and corporations and the way that it feeds off the super magnet that is Washington, D.C., ends up facilitating one another's incumbent positions. Now, on the foreign side, when a nonprofit receives these gifts in kind and takes them to a foreign market, well, yes, they can sell food, rice, for instance, at a lower price than Haitian prices. But if on the net, in the macro sense, we end up contributing to a system that actually displaces and decimates the Haitian rice economy, which is a chapter of the film that's covered, then the relative price for a poor person in Haiti doesn't go down but up. On paper it goes down, but because unemployment goes up, their purchasing power goes down and the relative price is higher. This is very interesting and important to look at. For those of you on your computers, you can search a video, a testimony by President Clinton. If you search, "We made a devil's bargain, President Clinton," you'll see a testimony where he admits that our policies, our agricultural subsidy policies combined with our trade policies with Haiti, decimated the Haitian rice industry. This is tied up with crony capitalism as well as aid, as well as the very role of the government, the way we conceive of the government and its involvement in industries such as agriculture. Then the third thing that we have to pay attention to is the aid community itself. So USAID tried to push procurement reform, meaning that as of now, USAID, when they try to support places like Haiti, they have to buy American and ship American. That's basically by law. And I believe it was 2012, they tried to push procurement reform to get permission to buy more locally. If we're going to provide relief in Haiti, let's buy more of it locally so we can support the Haitian economy in the process. And it was immediately shut down by what people call the Iron Triangle of Special Interests: the big ag and manufacturing, big shipping, and big NGOs, because each has a huge vested interest in the current system, even though white paper after white paper and story after story have come out demonstrating that it actually is harmful to Haitians in the long run. And so the way we have to get serious about this depends on where in that triangle we fit, right? So CARE, a famous NGO, they famously turned down over $50 million in monetization revenue that they could have accepted in in-kind donations from the government because they decided that this is not a practice they want to be a part of. There's a lot of NGOs still taking that money and still contributing to that system. And as voters, I think we need to get serious about, okay, if we want to create competitive market economies, real market economies, not just managerial state capitalism that favors big industry, but truly competitive market economies, we have to get serious about things like agricultural subsidies. You know, you can be for the American farmer and against agricultural subsidies. Those two are not mutually exclusive.
So I'm thinking of Tom's Shoes, which is a company that makes shoes, sells them, and then makes this pledge that if you buy a pair of their shoes, they're going to ship a pair to some poor person somewhere in the world. Is that a part of the problem?
I think it is, because now, is Tom's Shoes single-handedly decimating local markets? No.
But the good vibes that people, good feels that people get in the United States for saying, oh, well, I'm helping.
Right. Well, let's back up a second. So there's case after case after case in the film and elsewhere, and a lot of interviews that we shot didn't even make it into the film. There's case after case after case where when we come over with free stuff, whether they be actually physical products or sometimes even services, we can end up displacing the local producers and service providers who are trying to make a living doing that and contributing to their own building of the tax base and building of a culture where those needs are being met. When we displace those, there's a short-term effect sometimes of jobless people being put out of a job. There's a longer-term effect of that culture shifting, where the culture of risk-taking, culture of new ventures, culture of entitlement and dependency, you know, it's incredibly complicated, and we need to be very careful.
Local entrepreneurs, you talk about a culture of risk-taking, something that we like to say in the United States helped build the United States. Is there a sense from low-income people around the world that taking these risks might ultimately be meaningless if a bunch of the largesse, quote-unquote, from the United States and other developed countries can just drop in and destroy their livelihood?
It does. It does affect them. So, I mean, as an example, one of the most basic examples that Peter Greer of Hope International gives in the film is an example in Rwanda he came across where post-genocide Rwanda, a young man named Jean was trying to build an egg business, and he had gotten a microloan and was building this business, and he had bought the hens and made the investment. And then in one summer, a church from Atlanta, Georgia, trying to respond to the needs in Rwanda following this crisis, decided that they were going to ship eggs and distribute eggs in this community to meet malnutrition problems. Jono got put out of business in a single summer. The church kind of did this for a year and then took a bunch of pictures and went home. And not only did they end up destroying this. Yes, people got to eat eggs for a year, but not only did they destroy the local provider who was no longer able to just like put up shop again right away. But they really depressed the entrepreneurial spirit, because when people like Jean have this constant risk of just losing everything, it does not create a strong incentive for him to put it all on the line to grow something like that. And remember, a lot of these people are already struggling with all kinds of other barriers. Things like they're locked out of the formal economy. They're often paying bribes to local officials just for the right to be on a street corner to do their business. They don't have recourse to the justice system if somebody steals from them. So they're already in a very difficult environment, and then we can make it even more difficult on them.
And they're trying to integrate their work, their output, and their community spirit all at the same time. And it seems to be something that these gifts, which, I mean, it's easy to forgive people for not appreciating what they're actually doing to disintegrate these communities.
Right, and in our modern, in our modern day, with all these documentaries available and with so much travel available, it's really not about pointing the finger and criticizing people for wanting to get involved. But we also can't just rest on our laurels and be satisfied that with these old models of charity that we know now are really hurting people, because then it's not authentic charity. Authentic charity is really willing the good of another person, not just seeking that self-gratification that comes from that Tom's Shoes purchase. Oh, I know, I did something good. And circling back to Tom's Shoes, it's not that Tom's Shoes or any of these organizations or that church, for instance, are single-handedly decimating economies. They do have a macro effect when they're all added together. But I think more importantly is the cultural weight that Tom's Shoes' success puts behind this idea that shipping stuff to developing countries, shipping like our leftover stuff or even new stuff in the Tom's Shoes case, is going to help the problem. In many ways, we actually see that model, that way of going about things, that conception, that mental conception of charity being synonymous with that. That's really the problem, and that's where we have to be really careful and start speaking out against these type of one-for-one models that essentially envision, if you take them to their largest end, they envision a world where everything, all the needs of people in developing countries are met by benevolent consumers and providers in the West. And that's not a vision for human flourishing we want to get behind. And
no one wants to live that way.
No one wants to live that way. And poignantly in the film, a Haitian gentleman responding to a Tom's Shoes commercial. The Tom's Shoes commercials, the founder, Blake Mikowski, says this. He says, "I realize that if I could build a successful company giving away shoes, then these kids will have shoes for the rest of their life." And a Haitian gentleman watches that on an iPad, and he looks at us, and he just goes, "No one in Haiti wants to be a beggar for life. These kids don't want to be receiving free shoes from Tom's Shoes for the rest of their lives." Like, that's not the vision that Haitians want for themselves, and it's not the one that we should be celebrating here in the West.
So if we can forgive, you know, these Western ideas about how we benefit, you know, the least among us, people who want to have a better life, and we have this fabulous wealth. If we can forgive that, then what is the answer for? I mean, this is obviously a huge question, but what is the beginning of this answer to help these people secure their own ongoing sustainable prosperity?
Yeah, we have to think in terms of. We call it algorithmic thinking, and we need to shy away from singularities, right? Like the singularity of what is the answer. And a lot of people get frustrated with us, actually. They come to our website or they watch the film and then they want that donate here button, you know, that quick and easy thing. Okay, what should we all be doing? The reality is that each of us has different talents, and we are unique, and we have unique perspectives. We have unique opportunities before us. And so the role is much more decentralized. It's not about what is this one plan we should all get behind, but it is about how can I look at the world around me and apply my talents toward the service of others. And that's not just quarantined in the nonprofit space or in the government space. That's what businesses are supposed to do as well. You know, you look at needs, you look at problems, you try to solve them, and then the profit that you gain from that should be seen as an accountability system or a feedback system to get feedback from the people that you're trying to solve that problem for on whether or not you're doing a good job. And if that profit is coming in and you're being authentic as a person, as a person running that company and working for that company, you don't want to be lying to people, et cetera, or selling somebody on something fake. But I think that when we talk about the solution, we always come back to that first starting point, which is the person. And understanding ourselves as persons and also understanding the people we come into relationship with, whether it be a cultural relationship, economic relationship, et cetera. And when we try to see the person on the other end of every transaction, you know, there's a person on the other end of this watch I'm wearing. There's a person on the other, somebody's hands touched this and helped make it. You know, there's a great video by CEI called iPencil, and they do a great job of demonstrating the symphony of human interaction that goes into making something as seemingly simple as a yellow number two pencil. And I think when we what we tend to do in the nonprofit world is we tend, and even increasingly now in this new term we have social entrepreneurship, is we create these categories, these compartments. Over here is where people are doing good, and over here is just everybody else. And the reality is that all of those things encompass what we call the market economy. The market economy isn't just businesses. It's all free exchange, right? So it includes nonprofits. It includes universities. It includes all places where people are coming together and freely exchanging with one another. I pay a university. I take out a loan from a bank to pay a university for the right to sit in a classroom. The professor is there. He has a contract with that university for his services to be there to teach, and he gets compensated for that. He puts the money in the bank. If the school or the professor break that contract, either party has recourse for justice to a legal system that will facilitate that disagreement, that will broker that disagreement. So this is the market economy at work, right? It's not just McDonald's. And I think sometimes we create these categories where we start to lose sight of that those human interactions. Now, as persons, instead of just agonizing over what nonprofits I want to support to contribute to international development specifically, I think we need to think about all the organizations and services and products that we're connecting to, and try to think, okay, I have this ethos over here that drives me to donate to a charity or to have my company do CSR stuff or to quote-unquote give back. But what if I extended that ethos throughout all my activities throughout the year, or all my activities as a company, or through vertically integrate that through my supply chain? You know, that's where when we take that ethos and I start to see my suppliers, for instance, if I'm a business, not just as numbers on a balance sheet, but actually as actual persons, and being interested in them and being interested in how they can help me solve this problem for another person I care about called my consumer, you know, the customer. And when we start to do that, I think then we stop. It helps us resist the temptation to cut corners. It helps us resist the temptation to be fake, because we don't like to be. We want to be authentic in our human relationships. It's kind of written on our hearts to do so, and yet the further we distance ourselves from that concept of that we're actually dealing with persons, the easier it is to start to objectify them and to turn them into a number instead of an individual. I know that's a little bit, you know, abstract. I think that what it means for me personally is every time I buy something new now, I try to see if I can find a company who's willing to tell me about the values with which they made that product and the supply chain that is connected to it. And I find it's incredible with these supercomputers we have in our pockets. It's incredible how quickly and how easy it is for almost all of the things I buy to find companies that are telling me that story, that are using it as a competitive advantage, not because we feel sorry for people in these countries, but because we value them.
Mark Weber is a co-producer of the film Poverty, Inc. Subscribe to this podcast at iTunes, Google Play, and with Cato's iOS app. And follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.